This episode is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, February 16th, 1804, I'm going to paint a picture for you here. Roughly 70 U.S. Marines staged a night raid on an American ship, the USS Philadelphia. The ship had been captured by enemy forces, so the plan was to board the ship and burn it down. Under the cover of moonlight, these 70 U.S. Marines managed to distract the people guarding the ship, sneak aboard, and do just that, a successful, daring night mission, the U.S. at war. And if you're thinking to yourself, wait a minute, 1804, a war, it's not the Revolutionary War, it's not the War of 1812, we know when that happened. There's a Navy ship involved, so this is probably not part of the Indian Territory Wars. This is, of course, folks, from the First Barbary War, and it took place off the coast of Tripoli in the Mediterranean, and our main ally was Sweden. All of these things were very surprising to me, at least. So let's discuss. Here, as always, is Nicole Hammer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hello, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley is here as well. Hello, Kelly.
Hey there.
So, yes, to me, we're at war, and our main ally is Sweden, and we're in Tripoli. All these things, as I said, were a little surprising to me. So, Kelly, start to inform me and our audience. What are we doing over there?
Sure. So the First Barbary War pretty much takes place between 1801 and 1805. And the United States and Sweden are fighting against four North African states collectively known as the Barbary States. So today we would know this as Libya, Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. But what most people don't realize is that during this time, roughly 1 million Europeans are captured by Barbary pirates, and then they're sold as slaves between the 16th and the 18th century. So this is something that I think we don't talk about enough because so much of the Atlantic slave trade, dominates our conversation in terms of piracy and trafficking. But when we think about this moment, piracy is a really big deal. And when the United States ship, the Philadelphia, gets captured during Thomas Jefferson's watch, he has to make a hard decision about how he's going to deal with these pirates. And, you know, his first impetus is, I will not negotiate. And we see how that kind of works out.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't go so well.
Yeah.
Yeah. But look, the Mediterranean was a big part of European trade. I mean, this is where spices come through. It is one of the big portals in Europe. And so for the U.S. to be actively engaged in trade, it needs to pass into the Mediterranean Sea. And every time U.S. ships go through there, they have to deal with pirates, and it really begins to irritate them, in part because it's messing with trade, in part because of the impressment of sailors who get taken by these pirates. And there's an easy solution to this if Thomas Jefferson wants it. On his very first day in office, the Pasha of Tripoli comes to him and says, please give me $3 million and my pirates won't bother you anymore.
So there's an extortion attempt on day one of Thomas Jefferson's presidency, but he, of course, says no. What is your sense, Kelly, of like Jefferson's mindset at this point? I mean,
Well, it's a couple of things. You know, he says no, and the Pasha declares war on the United States. And I think Thomas Jefferson really doesn't want to have to deal with this. You know, this is also a moment where we're looking at the Louisiana Purchase and the expansion of the United States westward. And Thomas Jefferson is really focused on how can we concentrate all of our sources, politically and economically, to building up infrastructure in what is the new expansive United States of America. So he really sees this as a bleed on resources that are taking place all the way over in the Mediterranean Ocean or the Mediterranean Sea as something that he does not want to have to deal with.
And this is like a huge foundational debate among the founders during this period is where does the United States' future lie? Does it lie in relations with Europe and having those commercial ties and doing all of this trade? Or do we face west and plant the U.S. flag there? And, Kelly mentions the Louisiana Purchase in 1803. Thomas Jefferson unconstitutionally buys a whole bunch of land, doubles the size of the United States, and that's where he sees the future of the U.S. So why hang out in the Mediterranean and fight pirates when you could not do that?
And so you have this faction called the Anti-Navalists, right? And they're the ones who say, forget the ocean, let's go out into the West and fight land battles. But you
also
know,
very opposed to belly buttons.
That's right, exactly. but you know, is the real argument that's taking place at this point basically about what kind of empire is the United States going to have and what kind of expansion is it going to have? Or is there also a kind of anti-imperialist argument even this early and saying, like, look, we're this new country, let's just like chill and get our act together a little bit before all of a sudden we start pushing out in every direction?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that in some ways, you know, the United States military has not really been tested since the American Revolution. And this is their way to sort of prove to the world how they're going to negotiate or how they're going to deal with pirates and, you know, who's going to be able to dictate what happens on the seas and what control they have or lack thereof. So in some ways, I think this is about the military trying to prove itself as a force. But also, I think that it's about Jefferson trying to steer away as much as he possibly can away from these, you know, foreign engagements that don't really interest mm-hmm. him as much as westward expansion does.
And what's so interesting about that language of anti-imperialist, I do think Jefferson would think about it as like, we are a republic, we are different from these European empires, because he doesn't think of the U.S.'s expansion across the continent as an imperial action. I mean, we might think of it differently today, but he saw it as a rejection of the kind of empire that he was seeing begin to develop in Europe.
How does this war, this Barbary War, Nikki, start to wrap up? I mean, from what I gather, the U.S. can tell itself a story that it quote unquote wins, but I don't think it's exactly like a resounding victory necessarily.
Look, the U.S. likes to tell itself stories about how it wins wars, and I think that is the story that it tells about the Barbary Wars. There's, in fact, a second one, but it kind of just peters out. They end up signing a treaty in 1805 as the Marines were threatening Tripoli. The U.S. loses fewer people. 47 die on the other side, 13 die on the U.S. side. So I think that militarily it is more or less a victory. I mean, they managed to get the peace that they want without having to pay the giant ransom that had been demanded. And it was important as a naval victory and important for the U.S. Yeah. to frame it as a naval victory, because it was still a very young republic and it was really not clear that it was going to be able to last. And being able to show yourself as a military force, as it would again in 1812, was a really important part of securing independence.
I also think, if I could add to this, the fact that they are sort of given praise by Pope Pius VII, I think, states a lot. You know, he says, the United States, though in their infancy, have done more to humble the anti-Christian barbarians on the African coast than all the European states had done. Wow. And I think that's a real vote of confidence in the United States' ability to affect change in places where it doesn't necessarily want to be involved. It's trying to show the world, I think, early on, that it can be a forceful power.
I think that's a really important line, too, because this has all sort of been retconned 200 years later as America's first war on terror, because it's being fought against predominantly Muslim states. I think that's pretty problematic.
That's a line that's mm-hmm. been out there in the post 9/11 period. That's remarkable.
Oh, yeah. It was really popular in like the mid-2000s to call this America's first war on terror, because it was the U.S. fighting against the Muslims.
Yeah, right. Well, and I guess much like our modern war on terror, it's like a lot messier than people realize. And, you know, that's really hard to see who's a winner and loser and so forth. There is this interesting thing here, though. Both of you have talked about how this burnished our reputation, in a sense, on a world stage. Whereas, you know, it makes me think that, like, domestic expansion may not have done that, right? The rest of the world maybe was not looking at Louisiana Purchase. Maybe I'm wrong, but was not looking at the Louisiana Purchase and saying, oh, this means the United States is a player. And maybe these other acts kind of do a little bit more to announce our arrival.
Well, I think in a, you know, at this moment, I think you're only as strong as your military, or you're in some cases only as strong as your navy. And so for the long time, that is how the British, you know, ruled. It was their navy that allowed them to procure so much power and influence. And so being able to establish authority on the seas is a pretty big deal in terms of letting people know what you control and what you don't.
Yeah, and I think that it's important to remember that the U.S. was also still, I know I mentioned this, but like still very vulnerable. Yeah. And that's why the British attack in 1812, because it's not entirely clear that the U.S. can defend itself. And if you can't defend yourself, then you don't actually have independence. And so this is part of the U.S. flexing its muscles, showing off its navy. But it's also, you know, coming into conflict with empires in the Western Hemisphere, with Spain, with Russia as it gets further west. So there's a lot of imperial conflict happening on the continent.
Yeah. But that this thinking of this as a precursor to the War of 1812 is interesting. A lot of these same names show up. A lot of the sort of like naval, you know, the same ships, the same commanders and so forth are the ones who then in that sort of more prominent war end up being there. A couple little tidbits as we wrap up. I mentioned Sweden as our unlikely or maybe whatever ally in the opening. There isn't much to say other than it seems like Sweden was the other country that was basically like, we don't want to pay ransoms. We want to sort of fight. And now all of a sudden the U.S. and Sweden are aligned. But that's a nice little tidbit. Don't hear much about that.
We should be celebrating our alliance with Sweden more often.
There you go. Exactly.
Goes back way far.
And speaking of celebrating, there is a monument to this war. It was in the capital, but now it's in Annapolis. And it is the oldest war monument in the United States. It was made within a year or two and shipped back to the United States on old Ironsides, which ends up having its own story of its own. I can imagine, you know, walking through the U.S. Capitol and being like, oh, I get what that's about, and I get what that's about. And then be like, wait a minute, this is about the Tripoli?
The
what's going on
war.
Here? But anyway, it is there, and it is the oldest war monument that we have. Anyway, let's leave it there. That, I think, is a reasonable amount of time to spend talking about the Barbary War. Nicole Emmer, thanks to you, as always.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter-Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. You can get in touch with us. Send us an email, thisdaypod@gmail.com, with any questions or comments or suggestions for future topics. If you want to help support the show, listener support is a big part of how we make this show happen. There is a forum on our website at thisdaypod.com. You can support us one time. You can become a monthly donor. It helps support us and the larger Radiotopia network. So thank you to everyone who does that. Again, the website is thisdaypod.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.